and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast, a giant size edition, I should say. I am the great Ryan Last, and it's my pleasure to be with you once again for this episode as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road of wrestling history, a giant road. And we're going to be talking about here this week, but without any further ado, the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. Doing really, really good. Real quick off the top here, I want to thank everybody that's asked about my mom, and she's doing much better. She's now out of the hospital into rehab, and just want to thank fans for their concern and their prayers, and kind of want to get to that and make sure I did thank folks today.
We have heard from a lot of people. It's been very nice to see that so many listeners have been concerned about everything with your mom, and it's wonderful to hear, Ron, that she's doing much better. But I know there's also another thing you wanted to say here at the top of the show, a correction of sorts.
Yeah, you know, I want to be correct in this and everything I do, and that's because of you, Brian. You've kind of gotten me into this. You got me doing my research, and I did say concerning number 87 last week that Andre had never worked in Knoxville before, but I have found out I was wrong about that. He did wrestle there in September of 1974, so. Basically, what we're talking about is going to be Andre's first time in Knoxville for me as the new promoter there. And so I just want to straighten that out right now for fans that may find out that, hey, Andre wrestled there one time before he came, before you bought it. So this is Andre's first appearance for me, and we'll be talking about the big man himself today. And it is a giant of a story anytime you talk about him. And this one, I think, is going to be a real interesting one for fans. We're going to cover a lot of ground today, just like old Lightning when he's running full speed. we're going to get something done today. And I'm really looking forward to it. So if you would like, Brian, I'll jump right into it, man.
Well, let me just say for the listeners out there wondering, Andre worked one time for John Kazana in September of 74. He defeated in a handicap match Ron and Don Wright. It was in the midst of a run he had where he was going back and forth between Ohio and Tennessee. And once again, he defeated Ron and Don Wright. That was September of 74. We're going to now fast forward a few months later. You're now the owner of Southeastern Championship Wrestling. We're in 1975.
Yes. And, you know, I want listeners to be aware that, I know very little about Knoxville's wrestling history when I bought the business from John Kazana. And, you know, that's kind of crazy to be making that comment. You'd think you'd know everything about it. So I'm going to try my best in the future and from this point forward to speak of only things from my personal experience as far as Southeastern wrestling is concerned. And I have to be careful about talking about things that occurred prior to my arrival there because I really am not sure about everything that went on prior to my taking over there and starting my own company. So I was correct last week about Andre's appearance in this episode, and this will be the first time that he would wrestle for me as a promoter and owner of an NWA territory. I'm just going to take off, Brian. I'm really going to enjoy this one. I love to tell Andre stories, and I'm going to end this with a really good Andre story. But last week's studcast kind of brought to life the first Knoxville Coliseum show in January 1975. It was headlined by a world title match between champion Jack Briscoe and the challenger from the one-night tournament of Nelson Royal. It was supported by a number of great wrestlers from the Florida territory. And I really appreciated it so much, more than anybody had ever know about who they sent me and how they did support me for that first world championship match. And at the close last week, Brian, you asked me, how do you follow a championship card like that?
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to discuss today. And most of the discussion, in fact, is going to be about one man. And it wasn't by accident that this huge superstar happened to be in Knoxville on January 31st, 1975. I was very inexperienced at being a booker, and I was even more inexperienced at being a promoter. But I did know the importance of following a big event with another big event. And when you open a wrestling company and your business and your box office is small, like it was for me every card when I started there, every week is critically important. You must quickly begin to build momentum with your crowds weekly. And at the same time, you got to do your absolute best to maintain that growth, or you can soon be in real trouble. You can catch a point. You can reach a point where nothing seems to work. I mean, if you're not a good booker and if you're not you're doing the promotion job properly, it seems like after a while, nothing's working and business is not growing. And I had very little cash to pay for losses. So I could not afford to have a business that's going to go up and down. I needed that steady growth. And if you didn't have it and you were in trouble financially, you could be out of business quick. And so it's great to have an occasional big card, but it was disastrous to not be able to follow it. So 1 week after this big world title card, I'd done my homework and I followed that card up with a guy who was the best drawing wrestler in history, in my opinion. I brought wrestling's biggest man and biggest attraction to Knoxville. It would be the first time ever to wrestle for me as a promoter, and we were going to become great friends over the next 11 years, fabulous friends. One of my favorite wrestlers ever, Andre the Giant, arrives to help me maintain the momentum of Southeastern Championship Wrestling after that first world title card. And every card booked in my early days as a promoter was filled with this pressure of success. For a 26-year-old kid suffering losses each week, that pressure was absolutely intense at all times. So let me kind of begin by introducing everyone to one of the greatest men to ever live, in my opinion, Andre the Giant. I'd never seen Andre since Jacksonville, Florida, 2 years earlier. We talked a little bit in previous studcast about that Jacksonville, Florida experience. And that night was only the second time I'd ever met Andre. And we spent that Thursday night in Jacksonville in the same hotel. It was only the two of us staying there. And after the matches, we went to Andre's favorite place. And what was Andre's favorite place, you ask? The nearest lounge, which happened to be in the hotel. You know, Andre liked to have his drinks. He liked to relax. He liked to get away from the building. He just really relished those nights in which he could just have himself a good time. You know, and that's not such a big event for me. I'm there with him, just me and him. But it's going to be an extraordinary night for the owners of this lounge in Jacksonville. They're going to close that night talking forever about the biggest paying customer they would ever have. And I'm not talking just about the size of him. I'm talking about the quantity of alcohol he's going to consume in this night in Jacksonville. So I get my taste a little bit of how Andre likes to drink and what it's like to spend an evening with Andre alone. Andre's a rare individual. He attracts people like bees to honey. I mean, at 7 feet plus and normally anywhere between 400 and 600 pounds, there's no place for Andre to hide. anywhere. I mean, everybody notices him and everybody wants to meet him. You know, he was a walking billboard. He was accustomed to attention. And I always thought that Andre handled it very well. He was polite, jovial, and engaging, especially when he was in his element. And his element and comfort zone was with a drink in his hand. And when he was having a good time, Andre had a big smile on his face constantly. But I got a feeling very quick of the kind of man he was. Not only did he have a huge body, but Andre had a huge heart. We talked a lot that night in Jacksonville. When we weren't being interrupted by fans, which was pretty much constantly, and that's the way it is when you're out anywhere with Andre. We talked about his childhood, about his family, about his wrestling history. And I got this strange feeling right away of Andre's loneliness and the sad part of his life. It was just being constantly on the road. And there was a reason for that. And I don't know that wrestling fans really understand what that is, but Andre was so big, he could not work a territory regularly and live there because he had very few wrestlers his size to work angles and programs with. If you're a booker and you've got Andre in your territory, who the heck are you going to book him with? I mean, he's so huge. You know, it's very hard to find an opponent that matches Andre in size. And, so every other wrestler in the world, excluding the NWA World Champions, usually work full-time for one territory at a time only, with occasionally a weekend out to somewhere else, as I used to do going to St. Louis out of Florida. But Florida was my territory. Florida was my home. It's where I spent my life. It's where I had my everything was there. And Andre's, he's just on the road constantly. He's lucky if he's in a city or a territory for 4 or 5 days. And it's unusual for him to be there any longer than that. Probably never happened for him, as a matter of fact. It was really difficult for him because he's forced to move from territory to territory on a weekly basis. And he's being booked by Vince McMahon Sr. at this point. He never said it, but I could feel it. He exhibited this huge smile and grin when meeting others. But behind that smile, if you really knew Andre, he was not a happy man. We talked about so many subjects that night that would provide the foundation for our friendship that I would treasure for many, many years. I absolutely loved Andre the Giant.
Ron, curious about, you know, Vince McMahon Sr. was the booker for Andre. He's the one who sent him around everywhere. And of course, to a lot of people, he was quietly a member of the NWA. They didn't really publicize it as much, especially in New York, but he was a member and you were in the NWA. And it got me thinking about when you first took over Knoxville. You know Eddie, you know the guys in Georgia, but when you become a promoter yourself, do you call around at all anyone and not necessarily introduce yourself, but just say, hey, I bought this territory. I want you to know I may want to use some of your guys, like a Vince McMahon Sr. or any other promoters outside of like Sam Mushnick. When you purchase Knoxville, do you contact anyone just to say hello, just to let them know that you purchased the territory? What do you do?
Well, actually, I do. And we're in the coming weeks, pretty soon in the upcoming Studcast, I'm going to ask a favor of, Jim Crockett Sr. And he's going to send me Ric Flair and Ken Patera, to Knoxville to work the next Coliseum show. So, you know, I am building and I'm trying to get this great talent in there, and obviously, Crockett's sitting on some great talent over there, and Flair's a young guy, Patera's a young guy, like I am at this same time frame. And it was a great thrill for me to be able to get that match into Knoxville as one of my first Coliseum events. I'm not able to run in the Coliseum every week yet. We're building toward it. You can't go in there and not make money and go in there and lose money. I want to get big events in there. I want to get the biggest crowds I can. Then I have to back up into the small building again. And we're going to kind of talk about that some as this program goes on. But yeah, you do, call in favors. I'm going to get quite a few guys coming out of Memphis because I'm working a lot in Memphis during this time frame. So, yeah, I'm going to be asking favors, and I'm going to be using guys that I would normally not be able to use.
When you go and book Andre, does anyone, whether it's Vince McMahon Sr. or Andre's handler or whoever, do they tell you how to take care of him? Do they say, hey, please have a keg of beer ready? Please have a van ready? What do you do in advance of bringing Andre in to make sure that he's going to be happy?
Well, the great question, you know. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the logistics. Let's call it. I'm going to call it the logistics of caring and preparing for a visit from Andre the Giant. And nobody tells you what to do. I didn't have anybody. Vince, when he says yes, you can have him, Ron. He didn't say anything about what you need to do to prepare for him and to take good care of him. But boy, I really wanted to do the job right. So when he arrives in Knoxville on Friday, January 31st, 1975, I pick him up in my Cadillac at the airport. The airport's about 20 miles out of Knoxville. I was sure my car was going to be large enough for him before I got there. But when we got to the car and after getting his bags, I realized that I need something much larger than the Cadillac. He's going to be in my front seat and I'm in the front seat. It's like we're shoulder to shoulder. I mean, Andre is a massive dude and he takes up a lot of room. So thank goodness I had prepared better for his room accommodations than I did for the vehicle I was going to pick him up in. So after we made the 20-mile drive from the airport back to his hotel, I had stayed in this hotel before, and I knew the rooms were clean and nice, and the king-size beds were available. I had done my homework about where to put him up, and I wanted him to have everything he would need in one location. I had spoken to the manager of this hotel 2 days prior to Andre's arrival when I booked it about who I had coming, and I made sure he understood how important it was for me that Andre was happy with everything there. I knew they were going to give him the royal treatment. The manager of the hotel was like, wow, we're going to get to put to bed one of the biggest men in the world, and we want to take care of him. So, and they had a restaurant, and I even made arrangements with the cook at the restaurant the day of the matches to stay until after midnight, just in case Andre wanted something to eat before the real festivities take place. And by the real festivities, I mean, obviously you get the idea. So, I knew what the most important part of this preparation was going to be, where he was going to relax, and that would be in their lounge after the matches. So this hotel had a nice restaurant. It had a lounge built into the side of it, and it was a pretty big one. It was a busy lounge, and it had areas where it could be separated from all the onlookers. You know, I'd gone in, and I'd been in that lounge many times myself, and so I knew that there was going to be a place I could kind of get Andre stuck back in the corner where most people might not even realize he was there. So I made all the arrangements in advance with a lounge manager to get Andre in those areas to get him some privacy. They had no idea, just like the lounge owners in Jacksonville a couple of years earlier, what kind of unforgettable night they were about to have. But Andre is going to, he's going to rocket their pocket, so to speak. He's going to put some bread in their pockets there that night. And when we pull up to the hotel after making the trip back from the airport, Andre, first thing he notices is there's a lounge right next to the hotel, and there's a restaurant on the other side. And he gives me a big old smile, and he goes, you did good, Ron, you know. And I knew right then. That's all I wanted to hear, man. I had to make him happy because he was going to be a huge key to a successful future there as a Knoxville promoter. I was working just as hard at the same time building a great relationship with Vince Sr. because he was in charge of the bookings. So I knew from that night in Jacksonville 2 years earlier when Andre and I kind of bonded that if Andre liked working for me, he'd push Vince to get more dates with me. Dates on Andre were hard to come by. And every night with Andre was just like having a world champion on your card that night, defending the title. It's a big night for you. And I understood that. And I had to make Andre feel comfortable big time in this first trip into Knoxville.
Beyond the lodging and the lounging, I guess, as well, what other preparations do you have to make when you bring Andre into your territory?
It goes far beyond just the place he's going to stay. One thing I had to do, and this is most unusual, is I had to prepare the building for Andre. This night was not in the Coliseum. I didn't want to go back-to-back nights in the Coliseum. I had a fear that I might drop off going back to the Coliseum again. So the world title match the week before had been in the Coliseum, but we moved back to the smaller building in Chilhowee Park. It's a much smaller building than the Coliseum, but I was as ready as possible in advance, anticipating the size of this crowd that Andre was going to draw. So I spent the entire week that week reorganizing the building. I added more bleachers on the second level of that building, and I managed to get another entire row of ringside on the lower level. I added an estimated additional 500 seats that would be there for not just that event, but for all events going forward. And that was important for me. My building was small. I'm beginning to fill it up, and I want to, that adding 500 seats, it made a difference in my take home at the end of the night. And I'd always said, you know, thinking big leads to being big. And, you know, I was thinking big here. Let's get more seats in here. Let's keep them here so that we can grow this business in this building until we get to the stage that we can go to that Coliseum and stay there weekly. And that's going to be down the road a little bit because it's hard to get your business to grow that quickly. So I did not want to turn people away, but sometimes that's not such a bad deal when you turn people away. When that starts to happen, fans perceive your matches as being a hard ticket to get, and they consider your company being that much better than the one that was there before when tickets were easy to come by. So obviously, I don't want anyone to know I own the company because I'm a heel. But in my opinion, fans didn't need to know who owned the business, only that they liked the product. So they are not going to find out that I own the business until the war, 1979. They will find out who owns the company, and only then because of the Knoxville Five. And I explained that in a recent Super Studcast number 13, all about that war in 1975. And so we're starting to get momentum and to grow the company. Southeastern Wrestling was just beginning to make a name for itself. And in less than 3 months, that's starting to happen. And that's pretty amazing feat. I was very proud of that I could see that I may be able to make this happen. And that's just critical.
What was the building management like at Chilhowee Park versus the Knoxville Coliseum? You haven't talked about that really at all, but when you take over the town, when you decide to turn it into a territory, and you're starting to deal with these building managers who have previously dealt with Kazana, were they receptive? Were they cool? Were they happy? And specifically the Coliseum, which was a new thing going into the Coliseum, and eventually you would go there for every show. Were they excited about having wrestling there? But let's go back to what I was saying before. Chilhowee Park. What was the building management like? Were they okay with you leaving 500 chairs there?
Well, you know what they did? It's really funny, and I don't blame them, actually. You know, John Kazana's an older fella. He's probably in his 50s at this point, and he brings me in and introduces me to the management. It's not a nighttime event. Obviously, we go there during the day out to the park itself, and that's where the fair comes to Knoxville every year. It's in that same park. And when he introduces me, I can tell by the looks on those guys' faces, and there were three gentlemen there that were responsible for the building, that they looked at me like, wow, this guy's a kid.
Well, you were.
Yeah, and I was. I was 26 years old, you know. I mean, they're like, they're probably wondering, how in the world does a young guy like this expect that he's going to be successful at running a business in which Kazana hadn't done real super business there. You know, he'd had some great crowds, but he had not he'd not broken any records. And they probably looking at me and thinking, wow, you know, this may not work, you know. So it's it's really but the Coliseum is a little different scenario. And I get to be tremendous friends with the people at the Coliseum there. And they ask a lot of questions that the people at Chilhowee Park did not ask. And a lot of the questions they asked me were about my background in the sport, what I knew, why I thought I could make it draw. What were my plans to make things better and to make wrestling different and to be viewed different by the fans in the market itself and those people that aren't fans, even more than the fans that they do have? They realized that no one was able to run in the Coliseum for wrestling, and they just wanted to figure out and they wanted me to explain to them how I felt like I could make a run at the Coliseum and make it full time. I don't believe in that first conversation with them, I even told them I had an idea of doing it full time. I wanted to rent the Coliseum, see how well I did. And they asked me all those questions. I must have had the right answers. I'm going to hit that Coliseum three or four times in that first year. By the following year, I'm going to make that move there permanently. And that's a dramatic move for me as a wrestling company, out of that smaller building and into the Coliseum. Now, the park out there, when it comes summertime, has an outside amphitheater that holds thousands of people. Big facility. But then you got the rain problem. You can go in there and have a great card, and you start raining. Starts raining at 7 o'clock, and it rains till 9 o'clock, and your crowd's going to be half of what it would be if you get that many. So I've got a struggle out there in Chilhowee Park, but the Coliseum is the future, and I realize that. I know that that's going to be the case.
Ron, one more question before we move on with the show and talk about this card. You're coming off this big show that you ran at the Coliseum. Now you have Andre the Giant in there. Do you do anything special to advertise and publicize the show and Andre being in town?
Well, we do the same thing basically as we did for the World Championship. We go right back again with the posters. Your billboards are usually a one-month product. I think I did 3 weeks advertising the Coliseum, and then they were nice enough at the billboard company to throw me up a new front on the billboards that advertised the Andre show. So I even got a little billboard exposure for both of those events. So, you know, it helped me out in that respect. We did everything. We ran the ads, the newspaper ads. We publicized it exactly like we publicized the World Championship night in the Coliseum. I just wanted us to hold up. I wanted us to fill that building. I wanted them to cut us off in ticket sales because we had just filled that thing to its capacity. And that to me would have been it's a winner. I wanted to come back and not fall off into my house too badly. I'm going to fall off some because I don't have as many seats as the Coliseum does, but I maintained a pretty decent house that night, and I was really happy with that part of it.
We will return in just a moment with more about Andre the Giant as well as the details of the January 31st, 1975 show. But first, a word about the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 15, part 2, the Tennessee Stud's 10 most memorable matches.
Super Studcast are all super, but number 15 is special, as Ron describes the 10 most memorable matches of his career at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. These 10 are remarkable for the number of years covered and the opponents involved. Three world champions, Terry Funk, Ric Flair, and Harley Race. Two Riots, one hysterical and the other potentially deadly. Three Aussies in a wild six-man tag with all three Fullers backing each other up from A to V. Bob Armstrong to dangerous Johnny Valentine. A shoot with a good friend, Kevin Sullivan, and a historical Knoxville homecoming in 1985. More than 3 hours of fascinating wrestling history for only $2.99. It'll keep you on the edge of your seat at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Saddle up for super.
There you hear it, part 2 of Super Studcast number 15, the Tennessee Stud's 10 most memorable matches. Part 1 has been a very, very popular show, and I think everyone's going to go crazy for Part 2. Some NWA champions and much, much more on there. We'll have information at the end of the show, but once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. You can get in the door starting at just $2.99. It's the best deal in wrestling. But Ron, let's go back to this night. Let's go back to January 31st, 1975.
Yes, sir. Big night. I'm really excited with this prospect of what can happen here for me that night. And I think I've done a good job of placing it all together. And we've got a pretty good card. I'm just going to read this card from first match up to the main event and talk a little bit about each one. You got questions, Brian, you can jump in there too. First match is Luke Graham. Good name. Been around. Fairly good worker. And he wrestles a guy named Dean Ball. Now, obviously, Luke Graham wins that match pretty easily. Dean Ball, I'm just not at the point here where I've got the ability to get quality guys on every match, but it's getting better every show. And it's taken me a lot of work to get there. Second match that night is Professor Dale Lewis. He's going to beat Dennis Condrey. Then he's going to beat a guy named Jim Webb. And then he's going to take $3,000 challengers from the audience. So in essence, Dale Lewis is going to beat five guys in one night. And he does this as usual. This tremendous job with those challengers makes it look so easy to the fans. And he's getting so much heat by his smirk and the way he gets the microphone sometimes after he beats them and says, you know, is that all you hillbillies got? You know, don't you have somebody here that's tough? You know, I mean, he just really, really, he's really goading them with this $1,000 challenge, and he's giving them all this wrestling in it. They're seeing shoot after shoot after shoot. That is just making my night. I love watching those matches myself. It's a real pleasure. The next match on the card is Ron Wright. He's going to beat a guy named Joe Soto. Ron Wright is still highly involved. He is critical for me at this point, and I'm going to start really using him with me because I need something now to follow this match. So we're going to talk about that later on. That'll be part of next week's program, as a matter of fact. Danny Hodge is going to beat Ray Candy. Ray Candy's a pretty good worker. They have a great match. And Hodge is on almost all my shows. You know, I didn't really realize it until I started looking back at this, but Danny is there almost every week, and it's because I love him. And it's because he's got this tremendous wrestling ability, and I utilize him on TV. I put him on TV to show people how wrestlers wrestle, but at the same time, I give him the chance to squeeze the apple. I mean, I don't know if fans know about this. This is absolutely unbelievable what he can do with his grip. He has the best grip of any wrestler in history, no doubt. Maybe the strongest grip of any human on earth. And I used to take somebody out there. Hodge would do his interview, and then somebody would say, "Danny, can you squeeze this apple?" And he would pitch him the apple. And Danny would take those big old red apples. It didn't make any difference what kind of apple it was. And he would squash that in his hands. The juice would run down his arms and drip off his elbow. You could see the apples being crushed. It's like, it's unbelievable to watch it. You mean, it's like, wow, how can anybody do that? And his amateur background, sports writers loved him. They wanted to write stories about him because he was so famous as a amateur wrestler and being in the Olympics and all that. So he was just phenomenal for me to have that Hodge there on all these shows and to be able to do these feats of strength on television and to be able to have these newspaper articles coming week after week. And I'm getting him every week. So it was a part of my plan to educate the wrestling fans there, but I did not expect to get Danny as many weeks as I was able to get him, and I took him every time I could get him. The next match is match my own against a guy from the western side of Tennessee named Tommy Gilbert. Great little wrestler, small guy. Obviously, I beat Tommy. You know, he's smaller. He in fact, he's probably lucky to be 200 pounds. But he's a good wrestler. He moves good, and he's over on the west side of Tennessee. Next match is Les Thatcher and Nelson Royal, and they're going to beat. Here again, I got to take my hat off to the boys in Florida. Watts sends me Mitsu Yoshida and Hiro Matsuda. And Thatcher and Nelson Royal have just an absolutely crazy tag match with those two Japanese guys. Matsuda, personal friend of mine, hadn't seen him in years. Was great seeing him in the dressing room and being able to talk to him. I love Hiro Matsuda. He's a fine, fine individual. One of the greatest Japanese wrestlers of all time. So Florida's still helping me in some respects. So basically what happens here on this card is John Foley and Dutch Mantel, they're going to win. It's an 18-man over-the-top rope battle royal. They're going to win that battle royal, they're going to throw the giant over with my help. I'm going to actually go back to the ring, get involved in the end of the battle royal. I got thrown out, but I'm going to go back and get involved in it, and I'm going to help them get Andre over the top rope and out of there so that they win that match. Same time, Nelson Royal and Les Thatcher are going to come back down to get involved in the battle royal at the end. Ron Wright's going to come back down and get involved with me at the end. So there's a lot of things that happen in this battle royal. I'd anticipated a sellout, so I had to ring announcer tell the fans all night that they could now buy next week's ticket tonight so that they wouldn't get turned away next week. This was a sellout, and actually tickets were cut off. Ticket sales were cut off by a fire marshal. First time fire marshal had been there and done that. So the ending of the battle royal left everybody in the building standing. And when the matches were over, there was a line of people buying tickets for next week's match. In fact, we sold 50% of the seats available in advance for the next event. And that had never been done before. And it became a regular sales tool for me. Every Friday night matches, people could buy their tickets in advance for the following Friday night. Now, bear in mind, this was 1975. It was long before advance sale ticket outlets arrived on the scene. And I might have been one of the first. I don't know about this, but I might have been one of the first to create and implement this type of idea of selling people a ticket for next week at this week's event. It worked great for me.
I want to get back to the card and your impressions of everything with the card, as well as Andre's appearance there. But a couple questions for you, Ron. Looking back now, and knowing that you sold out and you did so well with the advance for the next show, should you have run the Coliseum for this show?
Probably. You know, I think that was a mistake I made, as I underestimated the momentum I was creating. It was really, really growing faster than I anticipated that it would grow. And so, yeah, I probably should have been in the Coliseum. You know, it's and as I said, they cut off the tickets that night. I don't know how many people got turned away. But as I said earlier, you know, sometimes that works for you, because people then get they realize that, hey, you need to go. You need to get your tickets early, and you need to get down there earlier. You may not get in the building. That just makes everybody want to see it more. So in that respect, I thought it was okay, you know. So I had to make announcements, you know, about that selling the tickets, and obviously sold all those tickets that night. And it was really, really a good idea that worked really, really well for me. So basically, great card that night, a big crowd. And most importantly, I got a lot of key people over for the next week's card. Foley and Mantell, Thatcher and Royal, Dale Lewis beat five guys. I mean, I got involved with Ron Wright's match, setting up a return with Ron Wright for the next week. Plus Thatcher and Royal got involved with Mantell and Foley, and they're going to be back the next week. So momentum is there to fill the building again the following week, and I'm excited about that.
Are you enjoying being a heel by this point?
I love it. I wish I'd have been a heel all my career. I just loved it. I mean, it fit me. I really loved being a heel, and I didn't think I was going to like it that much. But, you know, it's easier to be a heel than it is to be a babyface. And it's great to be able to lead the match. You know where you want to go, and you know what you think you can get out of a guy that you're working with. And it's more fun. It's a great deal to be a heel.
Dale Lewis, when he does the challenge, did you ever have a night where you couldn't find any challengers in the crowd?
They start to dwindle, you know, because the first time we did it, there was probably 15 people in line to do it. And he took two or three, and then he cut it off at that. Then the next week, there's probably 10 there. And the next week, there's seven or eight there. And now it's dwindling down to where he's not going to get three challengers before too long. And we're going to get to that. That's going to be very interesting for fans to see what the outcome is of all these challenges with Dale Lewis. We'll be getting to that as time goes on here. So it's a great night. And Andre's just fired up, man, about the reception of the crowd. He was really blown away by it. And it was always a pleasure for me to watch Andre go to the ring. I don't care what arena it was, what territory it was. You just see people respond to him differently than they do any other wrestler. And because this is only his second time in Knoxville, and because there's a lot of new fans in that crowd, his entrance needed to be spectacular. And this is a great example of a small detail making a huge impact. I had the announcer prepared, and I told him I wanted him to start announcing Andre from just before he exited the dressing room door and continue that entire announcement all the way till Andre got to the ring. And this guy did a really good job of it. And, when he said, ladies and gentlemen, and in this arena, it's a small building, it's not a coliseum, everybody can see the door he's going to come out of. They know where he's going to come out. And he starts announcing him before he comes out. And when Andre comes out the door, there's a big gasp from the crowd, because he bends way over. He's got forward, he bends his body forward to come underneath the door frame, and it accentuates his height, but it's even more accentuated because back in those days he had that big afro hairstyle. So he had and then when he bends over and he stands straight up as soon as he comes out the door, people were like, oh my God, they were just dumbfounded by his size. And Andre told me later, he said, I loved it. He goes, and that's exactly what I wanted him to tell me. I wanted him to love it. You know, Andre said, geez, nobody ever introduced me like that. He goes, wow. He said, they were into it. They were so into it by the time I got to the ring. So, you know, like I said, small details sometimes mean so much to create impact. So the boys treated him all night great at the building, and now we're headed to the spot Andre is going to enjoy the most. His evening is getting ready to take off.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ron, before we get there, I have one more question for you.
All right.
I have to imagine that the words a promoter never wants to hear are, the fire marshal just arrived. So tell me about what you're thinking that night. You're having this successful show, back-to-back great shows, a sellout, and you hear the fire marshal's there. Do you already have a relationship with them? Do you know them? Are you freaking out when you hear that? Is the building freaking out? Tell me what goes through your mind when you hear the fire marshal has arrived.
Well, I don't know them because I don't want to be known as the promoter. So I stay in the background for 5 years, basically. Nobody knows. And, you know, so the last thing I want to do is go down and talk to the fire marshal and try to talk him into letting more people in. I really considered it to be a good thing. You know, I mean, we've got a bona fide sellout, so much so that they tell you don't sell any more tickets. I've worked in Florida and a lot of shows there in which we oversold buildings dramatically, and fire marshals rarely cut you off. So this is, in a way, it's a bad situation because this fire marshal's likely to show up every Friday night now, because he's seen this huge crowd, and it's his job. I don't have no ill will toward fire marshals. It's their job to make sure people don't die in some type of horrible fire in which the building is way, way overloaded. So, in a way, I tried to look at it from a optimistic point of view that, gosh, we got a huge crowd here, man. They've had to cut us off. And that's kind of the way I kept that in my mind. An amazing, amazing night altogether. And Andre's already enjoying himself. He's had a great time at the matches. Everything has gone perfect for me with this first trip for Andre in, because I'm so dead set on making Andre. I'm dead set on making my territory Andre's favorite territory. And that's what's going to happen for me. He is going to tell me toward the end, Ron, I don't want to work any place else more than I want to work for you. I love working for you. So that's kind of what we accomplished in that night.
Okay, well, now we have to hear about what happened after the show. Tell us about...
Okay, well, you know, if you thought the crowd at the matches were blown away by Andre, well, you should have seen the crowd at the nightclub. You know, because at least at the matches, these people are familiar with Andre the Giant. They kind of know what to expect. But when you walk him into a nightclub, I mean, it's a whole different ballgame. So they were not prepared at the nightclub for what they were about to see. I went with him. We went to the front door, the entrance to the nightclub, and he went in ahead of me. And when he dropped his head, he also turned his body kind of slightly because the entrance wasn't wide enough for him either. So when he dropped his head real low and he turned his body slightly to the side, and he went through that entrance kind of sideways, and then when he stood up inside, well, you could have heard a pin drop in that place. I mean, everybody there, and there was probably 200, maybe more people in there. It's a big nightclub. And I mean, everybody went quiet. Everything stopped. The patrons, the bartenders, the waitresses, everybody in the place were totally speechless. And I looked around and their mouths were open. It was like almost like a joke. You know, like, oh, they couldn't even talk. They couldn't say anything. The band stopped playing. I never saw that ever in a nightclub. The band just quit playing. It's like everybody just stopped. It was like the whole place just went silent. And so we walked to the back of the club where I knew the reserved area was for him. I was waiting to see the same reaction countless more times. I'm going to see this so many times going out and partying with Andre over the years in nightclubs all over the country and all over the world. I'm going to see Andre just stop the show basically every time he goes in one of these clubs. And boy, he sure did it in Knoxville that night. Those people just were freaked by him.
Must be weird for you walking into a club and you're not the tallest guy.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted him to go first. You know, I wanted to get that impact, man. But I had no idea it was going to be that strong. I'm going to talk about this night now because it's in chronological order for my studcast. There's going to be many more stories about Andre, but they're going to be told when we reach other Andre events as my career goes by. And if for fans out there, you know, if you really want a fantastic feel for Andre and all the great stories in one show, you might want to listen to Super Studcast number one, because it contains 3 hours of some of the best wrestling stories ever about one of the greatest wrestlers ever. But we're going to continue as we chronologically get to different times. And every time Andre comes in, we're going to have Andre stories. And so we were in the club now, and we're back in the corner there, basically, and we're half hiding, but everybody knows you're there. You know, I mean, they've seen us walk through there, so they know we're there. So several heels show up, and they sit with Andre and I. I'm not concerned about kayfabe this night, because Andre, he's not a member of my regular crew, and people really don't know whether he's a babyface or a heel, especially those people in that nightclub. They don't know. Most of them probably didn't go to the matches, obviously, and it's also the first time he's ever been there for me. So we quickly get the idea of how Andre wants to party. I'll tell you that. I wanted to pay for the drinks, and I always did this every time we ever went, and very seldom. I think on a couple of occasions, Andre allowed me to do it. But I always said, Andre, I want to get your drinks and everybody's drink. Oh, no, Ron, no. You know, I was like, well, yeah, Ron, please, Andre, you know, no, Ron. You know, he was very serious about that. So he wanted to pay for the drinks, and he wanted to pay for everybody's drinks. Okay. So, like most wrestlers, beer's the preferred drink, you know. So Andre would order. Here's the way Andre would order. He would order a round. The waitress would come and he would say, 6 for me and 1 for them. Okay. So he's going to drink 6 beers while you drink your 1 beer, okay? And most of the time, he would finish his 6 before anybody finished their 1. So, I mean, he's really putting them down. And you know, they're serving beer in cans back in those days. And when he picked up a can, you couldn't see any part of the can. It was in his hand. His hand was so huge, the beer can was lost inside of it. And when he turned it up, it looked like he's drinking out of his hand, because you couldn't see any of the beer can. So, and you know what? You have no idea how many beers he drinks in a night. It's the first time he's there and the first time I've experienced him buying the beers for everybody. And so the next visit he makes, I'm going to be prepared in another way. I'm going to be prepared to count those beers during the course of the night, because I'm like the other heels that were with me that night. They said, how many beers you think he drank, man? You know, and we were kind of guessing at it. And I figured it was at least 100 beers. And he showed absolutely no sign of having drank a single one of them. I mean, I never got over the fact in all the years I knew him that Andre could drink as much as he wanted, and I never saw him drunk. It was really amazing how much he could drink.
You never saw him drunk? Did you see him hungover?
No. As a matter of fact, I don't believe I ever saw him hungover. I saw him on a few days, one trip we made to Dothan, Alabama, first time I opened up Southeastern in Pensacola. And he got up that morning a little bit out of sorts. I guess that would be a good way of putting it. And he wanted me to keep people off of him in the Atlanta airport. You know, Ron, don't let people bother me. And he took a newspaper and spread it over his entire upper body, trying to hide who he was, right? Like people weren't going to notice him, you know. And so there are times when he's not quite as happy in the morning as other times. But so the next morning I pick him up at the hotel, and I'm going to take him to the airport. And I ask him, did he eat breakfast? And he says, no, he hadn't had breakfast. So it's my first meal to eat with Andre. I'd never seen him eat before. So I ask him where he wanted to go. And he said the name that he almost always said to me after that. I can't imagine this, and I don't have any reason for it or whatsoever, but Andre's favorite restaurant was the Waffle House. and I mean, I was going to learn as years went by that this was his favorite place to eat. And so I'm going to take him to the Waffle House. And so we go in the Waffle House, and there's one not too far from the hotel. It's kind of on the way to the airport. And we get in there, and I sit down one side of the bar. He sits on in the booth. I can't imagine how he's going to squeeze into the booth, but he shoves that table over to where I can't breathe hardly. He's taking most of the table, but it's just me and him. And the waitress brings us menus, and then she's gone, and she comes back. And she must have recognized who he was, she asked me what I want, and I tell her what I want, you know, regular type of breakfast. You know, I'm eating more than most people, but certainly not what Andre probably is going to do. I have no idea what Andre is going to order. So he's holding the menu, and she says, Mr. Giant, Mr. Giant, what would you like? You know, and he said, he's holding the menu, and he kind of puts it up toward her face, and he goes, I want the menu. And she says, she's confused. I could see it in her face. And she goes, Mr. Giant, you have the menu. And he says, no, I want the menu. And she says, you mean everything on the breakfast side? He's showing her the breakfast side of the menu. And he goes, yes. And she goes, you want everything on the breakfast side of the menu? And he goes, no. He goes, I want everything on both sides of the menu. It's like, I'm like, oh my goodness, Andre, are you serious? Right. I mean, so heck, I get my stuff and they start bringing his food. He starts out, she says, which side do you want first, Mr. Giant? I want breakfast. And then he's going to eat lunch and dinner too. You know, so, it took, I don't know how long we were in that restaurant. It was just unbelievable. They just kept bringing plates. Once I finished, they took my plates. They filled the table with food, and he would eat this, and the girl was right on top of it. She'd take the plates, and she'd take another one, and then another one, and bring back three and take three. And it was like, wow, this just kept going on. It seemed like forever. I'm thinking, Andre, we're not going to make the plane, you know, like, I'm getting worried here, man. I'm not going to be able to get you there in time. But that was just an unbelievable thing to watch a human being eat that much food at one time. That wasn't the last time I watched him eat the menu. That's what I would call it. Andre, you going to eat the menu? Yes, Ron. I'm going to do the menu. So it was amazing to watch him eat.
Who paid the bill?
I picked up his tab. And, you know, and he very rarely let me do that type of stuff. But it was my first time. It was his first time there. He had bought all the drinks the night before. I had no idea what that tab was. But I really, you know, I just insisted, you got to let me get this. You got to let me get it, Andre. If I had known he was going to order the menu, I might have had second thoughts about getting it. You know, I figured he'd have three times what I had, but I had no idea he's going to have everything that the Waffle House cooked in one meal, all of it. So, it's pretty, pretty amazing. Great little experience though. And I just really, really loved that guy. He was just an unbelievably different human being.
As Ron mentioned earlier, you could hear 3 hours of Andre the Giant stories on Super Studcast number 1, which of course is available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. But on the topic of Super Studcast, we want to remind you part 2 of Super Studcast number 15 with Ron's 10 most memorable matches is now available at both tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. You get in the door starting at only $2.99 for 3+ hours of unique wrestling history. Think about some of these names that Ron's going to talk about. Terry Funk, Ric Flair, Harley Race, Bob Armstrong, Johnny Valentine, Kevin Sullivan, riots, Australians, shoots, and a fantastic Knoxville homecoming in 1985. Hear all of that today. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. You can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook, the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. Ron, this has been a fantastic episode, a giant size episode. I'll use the same pun right here at the end of the show. But where are we going next week?
Well, next week we're gonna have a great program next week too. We're gonna talk about the first big angle on TV. I'm going to work with my secretary and Ron Wright, and this one, I tell you, it's a kicker. It's a really, really good little angle I come up with, and just really, really puts a lot of butts in the seats for the next week and the card that follows that TV. We're going to talk about other cities that I'm wrestling in at this same time frame. I'm doing every Monday night in Memphis. They're going to stick me into Louisville, Kentucky some, because that television goes into Louisville. I work in Chattanooga on Saturdays sometimes. We're starting to open up the Tri-Cities up there in the northeastern part of Tennessee, Johnson City, Kingsport, and Bristol, Tennessee. We're going to start wrestling up there. We're now on television up there. Where I'm going to be wrestling at this time, I'm going to be having some problems with my TV commentator, Big Jim Hess. We're going to get started talking some about the television that is, in my opinion, very inferior to what the heck I want to do. I'm not proud of it, and things have to start changing in that direction. So I think we'll have a great program next week.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6'9" tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Brian Last.
Next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.